Senator Larson. Senator Larson, Senator File 893 is before us.
Thank you, Senator Rest and members of the committee. Senate File 893 moves the state primary from September to the first Tuesday after the first Monday in June. And Madam Chair, to get the bill in the order that I would like it, I'd move the A3 amendment.
Do we have the A3 amendment?
As the A3 amendment's being passed out, Madam Chair, I would just point out that the A3 amendment is intended to correct. Actually, as the bill was originally drafted, it did not reflect the first Tuesday after the first Monday. It was just the first Tuesday. And to avoid the primary being the day following Memorial Day, we needed to make that change. That's an important point. That's in the amendment. In addition to council finding in the statute the need to affect the filing periods for local units of government as well. And so that is in the amendment. And again, I'd move the amendment.
Thank you for explaining it, but this is an author's amendment, and so we will adopt it. Senator Gerlach moves, Senator Larson actually can move adoption of the A3 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Ayes have it. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. We now have the bill before us as amended. Senator Larson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I wanted to move one more oral amendment that was something that I overlooked in requesting my amendment of counsel, and that is on page 5, section 10 of the bill, is the effective date. And just to give members a little bit of background, because this is more than just a technical amendment in terms of implementation of the bill, but as we've been working on this bill, and when I say we, many, many different groups of people, including what I'm very proud to tell you today, has the support of the Republican Party of Minnesota, the Minnesota Democratic Farmer Labor Party, and the Independence Party, and also has the support of the Council of Electoral Leadership. And as all the groups have come together to discuss this election reform bill, one of the things that allowed us to do that was to push implementation out to 2010. So that we are not today discussing how this will impact our next election, but it's, in fact, a structural reform and how it will impact Minnesota's election future. And so, Madam Chair, I would move on line 5.8, delete 2008 and insert 2010.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We have had a state primary in Minnesota in the month of September since 1939. And, Madam Chair, a number of times, especially in recent years, there has been an attempt to move our state primary from September to June or earlier in the year. And as a result of going back to 1995, many of us know of the Grow Commission, and one of the findings was to try to move up the primary. And in fact, the proposal did pass the Senate in 1995. In 1999, it was tried again, and to move the primary to the first Tuesday in June, and that passed in the Senate in 99. And there have been other proposals as well, and in fact, as recently as Senator Higgins introducing this in a session in the last two legislative sessions. And so, Madam Chair, it is my belief and the belief of many people, and I'm going to move quickly to quickly go through the bill and then move to testifiers, because I think the compelling story to tell here is that a lot of groups have come together to support this election reform bill that would move our state primary from September to June. So as we just quickly move through the bill, the first section on page one is where we change the distribution of party accounts and taking care of that detail as it relates to public subsidy. On page two, we had to clean up some language as it relates again to moving, as it relates to the agreements that candidates sign with the campaign finance board. Section four on page three, as it relates to affidavits of contribution. Madam Chair, the state notice filing on page four in section six. The heart of the bill, Madam Chair and members, is moving up the state primary so that we will have a longer discussion about who should be our office holders in Minnesota, and a shorter discussion about which Democrat it ought to be, which Republican or which Independent or whichever party that we're talking about. But that we have resolved in June who the candidates are, who the nominees are, chosen by the public to be on the ballot in November for Minnesotans to make a choice, whether it's at a local level, state legislative level, or for offices of governor or United States senator. And I think that Minnesotans will benefit a great deal from what I believe will be a more in-depth campaign on the issues rather than just the six-week narrow window that we are provided post a September primary. The other issue that I would raise as well that we accomplish with this bill is one of the problems that we've seen in recent elections as it relates to the concern over military voting and the ability of our voters, of men and women who are serving outside of Minnesota or overseas in the armed forces. Given the fact that the primary is so late, oftentimes our military voters are disenfranchised and don't have their votes counted in the November election. And by moving the primary up to June, we have the opportunity to make sure that those ballots are counted. And so, Madam Chair, I would I know that we have Mr. Brian Melendez from the DFL party. I'd ask him to join me here. And we have a number of people that have asked to testify on the bill.
Welcome to the subcommittee, Mr. Melendez. If you'd identify yourself for the record, we'd
thank you, Senator.
Have your testimony.
My name is Brian Melendez, and I'm here in my capacity as chair of the Minnesota Democratic Farmer Labor Party.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Senator, I know you have a long agenda today and many speakers, so I will try to be brief. The Minnesota Democratic Farmer Labor Party is in favor, in fact, enthusiastically in favor, of the bill that Senator Larson is carrying. I testified in the last legislature when Senator Higgins was carrying a similar bill. The party has been in favor of this change for quite a while. I think Senator Larson puts it very well when he says that the focus should be on who's going to be the better public office holder, not on who's the better Democrat or the better Republican or the better Independence Party member. I would put it a little bit differently, that this bill is not so much about politics as it is about good government. This refocuses the debate in the election cycle on who is actually going to hold the office rather than the party nominating process. Right now, we spend the entire months of May, June, July, and August, and about a third of the month of September basically playing inside baseball, and then we give the voters less than 2 months to judge the product of the partisan process's work. I think it would be a wonderful thing to reverse that cycle and spend more time having the voters make their decision rather than having the parties make decisions. The DFL party is also very much in favor of a change in the primary date to late February.
The caucus date.
To late February. That would let us line up with Wisconsin's primary. Hopefully it would bring a little more attention to Minnesota as a presidential battleground state. I understand that there have been some suggestions that that date be moved even earlier. We would be opposed to that just because it takes us quite a while after the holidays to ramp up for the caucuses. We could easily accommodate a late February date, but a date any earlier than that would be very difficult. Having said that, Senator, I hope that the subcommittee will act favorably on the bill and that the full Senate and the full legislature will pass this bill. It's been a much-needed reform for a long time.
Thank you, Mr. Melendez.
Thank you.
Senator Larson, I only have two other names. I'm assuming that there may be more people that want to testify.
Madam Chair, why don't we go in the order of the names?
Oh, in the order. Mr. Kelly Doran.
Madam Chair,
welcome to the committee.
Members of the
if you'll identify yourself for the record.
My name is Kelly Doran, and I am here today as the chairperson of the Board of Directors for the Council of Electoral Leadership and to offer testimony in support of the Senate Bills 839. Just to give you some background information, the Council for the Electoral Leadership is a relatively new organization, just really founded here after the last election. We have brought together literally scores of individuals from across party lines, people who have historically been partisans, and we brought them together to talk about this issue and other potential electoral issues that may come at us in the future. We brought together Democrats, we brought together Republicans, we brought together independents. We have members who are former chairs of the party, former candidates, former elected officials. We brought together leaders of the unions. We brought together leaders from the chambers of commerce. So this is a diverse and broad group of people who come together really for one common goal, and that their belief is, as Chairman Melendez said, is that we need to make some modifications in our electoral process in order to allow for more participation in the process. And we believe the first step of that is to move the primary forward into June. That will allow the candidates of the respective parties to really go out on a grassroots effort and to market themselves with their own ideas and their own agendas through the course of the summer months and into the general election. We think that's a much better process than simply having the parties have intra-fight parties through the course of the summer months, have a primary in September and a general election 6 or 7 short weeks thereafter. We think it will reinstill retail politics. I mean, think of the funness of through the course of an election season around the state, where candidates who will really have a shot at being elected can face off against each other at county fairs or at local meetings or anything else that happens around the state and really have an interesting and diverse debate about the issues that affect and how they feel about those issues. That, we believe, will facilitate voter participation and voter involvement and hopefully lead to greater and greater participation in the primary, in the general election, as well as earlier participation in the primary in order to select these candidates. So we're here to do that. I'm also here to ask any questions, answer any questions you might have. We think that this is not there are some that will argue that this is extending the time periods for the electoral process. We believe that's, in fact, the opposite effect. We believe it's time to have a greater debate about the general election and a shorter debate about the candidates from their respective parties. As one who ran for office and who gave serious consideration to running against a potential endorsed candidate in a particular party, I have come to my senses and realized that that is a very difficult thing to do in any of the parties. And I think by having a process that brings the primary closer to the endorsement process of each of the parties, that will lend strength to the political endorsement process in all of our parties. And this is not a bill about one party having benefit over another or one election cycle having benefit over another election cycle. This is a long-term view about what's good for the state of Minnesota and how can we increase participation. And that's what brought this diverse group of people together, people that don't agree on very much in a political realm but do strongly agree that this is the right thing to do for the state of Minnesota. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Doran. Mike Franklin. Welcome to the subcommittee. If you'd identify yourself for the record.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Mike Franklin. I'm the Director of Elections Policy for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce and our 2,400 members. I'm here today to speak in favor of Senate File 893 as part of our agenda to increase participation, accountability, and responsive government, and to increase private sector and business participation in elections. We believe that a June primary would encourage more private sector candidates to run for office and to participate in the nomination process, that it would strengthen political parties by helping recruit better and stronger candidates and help nominees focus their time, energy, and money on the general election rather than on an intra-party fight. By virtue of this more inclusive process, we believe the legislature is even more likely to represent the state's overall population and workforce. And so, Madam Chair, Senators, Minnesota Chamber of Commerce supports the passage of Senate File 893, and we stand ready to help this along to quick passage. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Franklin. Senator Larson, do you have other witnesses? We have one more person who's given us their name.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know that informally I had had some folks who had said they may be signing up to testify, so I don't have anyone else other than I did want to mention that how appreciative I am for the DFL party chair, Mr. Melendez, for being here today, but also to mention when we had our unveiling of the legislation, if you will, as you were there as well, Madam Chair, and Senator Gerlach was there as well in a very bipartisan spirit. The chair of also the Republican Party, Ron Kerry, joined us, as did the chair of the Independence Party, and want to make sure that the committee understands that they are supporting the bill as well. Ready for the next testifier.
Another name I have is Becca Price. Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Becca Price, and I'm here representing the Minnesota Association of County Officers, which includes the auditors and auditor treasurers. First of all, I just want to let you know that the MACO has not taken a position on this, but we have had some discussion. Just want to put some thoughts out there for the committee to consider. Election administrators do support an early primary in order to provide more time between the primary and the general election to process overseas ballots and military ballots, and more time to program equipment and ballots. So we're really thankful that this discussion is happening. There's not complete agreement among our members that June is the right time for a primary. Some think August would be better. Some think June is okay, but maybe the second week of June would be better. Many of our counties do have combined auditor treasurer offices, and many of them are very busy in May with property tax collections. Some of the larger counties have dedicated election staffs and are better able to handle this workload, while some of the smaller counties are concerned that the timing might put stress on their already over on their busy offices during this busy time. That said, we do want to say that county auditors and auditor treasurers have a history of making things work at the local level, and we appreciate the working relationship we are developing with the Secretary of State and appreciate the authors of this bill that are looking for our input. We're very willing to work with the authors, and at the end of the day, we'll implement what becomes law. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Price. Mm-hmm. Is there anyone else in the public that would like to speak either in support or in opposition to this bill? Welcome to the committee. If you would identify yourself for the record.
I'm chair, members of the committee. I'm Kent Sulem with the Minnesota Association of Townships. And I guess I would echo some of the comments just made by Ms. Price. Our association has not taken a formal position one way or the other in this bill. The one concern we'd just like to make the committee aware of is our town clerks are elected in March of the even-numbered year, which means they take office late March, early April, as the contest period ends and they take their oaths. And so there are training for those clerks how to run and administer elections occur in July with our current training schedule. And so as a practical matter, we may have to look at there'd be a lot more reliance on the counties as opposed to our association and our current arrangement with the Secretary of State in order to get very quick training for clerks to be able to administer an election as early as June when they don't even take office until early part of April. So I just wanted to flag that as an administrative issue that will need to be addressed.
Thank you. That's an excellent point. I'm sure that's true in other in other venues as well. Is there anyone else who would like to testify in favor or in opposition to this bill? Seeing none, Senator Larson, do you want to make a motion?
Senator Moore. I can count votes. I see four of the six members of the subcommittee are co-authors.
Good of you. But you may talk anyway.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do share Ms. Price and Mr. Solem's concerns about difficulty of absentee voting for people overseas, and I think you and I and a lot of us have been interested in improving our absentee ballot process to address those issues, and I think there's a lot we can do short of making the elections a lot longer. But a couple of comments. One, both to correct Senator Larson, Mr. Doran, I don't know that we've ever had a 6-week gap between the primary and the general. I count 8 weeks all, but maybe once every other decade, it's a 7-week period. It is a little bit, 8 weeks is generally the period we have. And I also agree with you about the fact that we spend disproportionate amount of our time in the pre-primary, the party selection process. That part is too long proportionate to the rest of it. We spend too much energy, political energy and money and everything on the internal party selection process. But this bill doesn't address that. This bill adds to the length of the general election campaign. And I would make the case that increasing the length of the general election campaign, making it too long, doesn't do anything to address the problem with the too long of the other portion of it. And I think the only way you can address the length of time candidates are spending campaigning would be through some significant campaign finance reform that I think there's been very little appetite for around here. But a couple of quick responses to things. One, I think several of the witnesses and Senator Larson talked about how this will increase participation. I believe the opposite's true. I think in terms of you look at other countries, European countries have much shorter election campaigns. They have much higher voter participation. We have one of the latest, I don't know that we're the latest, but one of the latest primaries, one of the shortest general election campaigns. We have the highest voter turnout and participation in the country. Why is that? That's not just fluke chance. It's just there's a reality to the fact that people, campaigns seem to drag on and on. People get sick of them. And this will make it longer. The biggest change the public is going to see, they're not going to see candidates that are still going to be spending all summer, as Mr. Duran said, they're going to spend all summer campaigning anyway. They're going to be going to all the county fairs. They're going to be doing it. Legislators are going to be out door knocking. We're going to be campaigning the same way anyway. The biggest change the voters will see is they're going to have TV ads 3 months earlier. And that's where we get people turned off. We're going to have television ads beginning in March or April instead of June and July. That's the reality, and that's what turns people off to the point that they're already sick of the campaign before they ever start paying attention. I think a lot of people say, yeah, I'll pay attention to what the candidates are saying. It gets a couple weeks before the election or so, and they're turned off because they're so sick of the disgusting ads. And I'm glad Senator Larson's able to bring the parties together, but I mean, the parties are the ones who run more of those 30-second ads than anybody. I mean, the political consultants, you look at who's behind it. I mean, all the people in politics seem to think this is a great idea to have longer campaigns, and you go out on any street corner or scientific poll or non-scientific poll, you're going to have 90% of the public saying our campaigns are too long already. Making them longer is not the answer. And I realize we bottled this up in the elections committee last time because the votes were different. But I realize that it's got the votes here. I just think if the public had its say on whether we have longer campaigns or shorter ones, they'd say we want shorter ones, not longer ones. And what they're going to notice is ads, television ads, that get them sick of our whole process, 3 months more of them. And I think you're going to have more people turned off to the process, not more people involved. Contrary to what the proponents of this say, I think if you have a short, concise campaign, you tend to have more involvement. And the only evidence I can give is the fact that countries that have shorter campaigns tend to have more involvement. States that have shorter campaigns tend to have, at least in Minnesota's case, have more involvement.
Senator Larson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciate your comments, Senator Marty. And you and I have had conversations about this for quite some time. And we learned very early on we probably wouldn't convince each other. But I would just argue that I think rather than what we're doing here, I don't believe that we're necessarily lengthening the campaign. I think we're changing the time periods in which there's intensity of campaigning. I just point to the United States Senate race that we're about to see unfold. We've just finished the past election cycle, and we have a United States senator that is presumably going to run for re-election, and we have two announced candidates. We have two candidates who are kind of have a toe in the water. It seems to me the campaign is already beginning. And so I'm not sure that with the timing of when we have the primary that we affect how long a campaign season we really have. But it's my belief that that we will be better served by having earlier nominees and having a longer general election campaign for candidates to articulate the differences between the parties, and I'd appreciate your support.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, one more comment on that. I think the idea that longer periods can get more information out to the voters is not there. Look at all the advocates of the bill are the ones who run these 30-second meaningless commercials. I mean, they're meaningful because they affect voters, but they don't provide any information. I mean, it's a cancer on the political process that we have these 30-second things. They tell you how slimy the other side is. They tell you stuff that's often misleading. It's not just the TV commercials, but the brochures and so on, and both parties do it. And that does nothing to improve the process. Candidates, Mr. Franken and Mr. Cerisi and others who may get into the race, they're going to make their decision based on when the election is, when they want to do it. They may not announce earlier or form a committee earlier, but they're going to start their TV ads earlier. They're going to just move up the whole thing. If we set the primary in June, they'll start the ads in March and April. If we set the primary in March or April, they'll start the ads in January. And it's going to lengthen the process for where it hits the voters, and that's what turns off the voters. If we could somehow get rid of those, replace the ad campaign system we have now with one that provided useful information to voters. I mean, if the parties were out there trying to say, we want people to know what our candidates stand for, and really substantive issue campaigns, I think they could get it out in a lot less than 8 weeks.
Is there further discussion on Senator Larson's motion that Senate File 893, as amended, be recommended to pass? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails and the bill is passed. The next bill up is Senator Erickson Ropes, Senate File 1218.
Madam Chair, committees, members, I'm happy to be here today. Or, Mr. Chair, excuse me.
Thank you. Senator Ropes.
Committee members, I'm happy to be here today with Secretary Mark Ritchie. We have a bill having to do with election law. And before we begin, I believe you have a copy of an amendment. Is that true? Being passed around?
It's being passed out. Thank you.
I would offer the A1 amendment as an author's amendment to Senate File 1218, which we're calling the military voting bill.
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ropes, since you're not a member of the committee, you can't offer the amendment, but I will do that
for you
as an author's amendment to get it in the bill in the shape that you would like us to consider it. So, Mr. Chairman, I move the A1 amendment to Senate File 1218.
Senator Rest moves the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape that the author would like it. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Senator Ropes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Rest. I put before you Senate File 1218. It's a Uniform and Overseas Citizens Absentee Voting Act. And I'll just tell you briefly what the bill is about. Section 1, and I'm not going to read all of this to you, but just to remind you, Section 1 deals with procedures for people who live permanently outside the territorial limits of the United States but who have a parent who is eligible to vote in Minnesota. Section 2 deals with voter eligibility. Section 3 deals with electronic mail requests by voters. Section 4 just is a little elimination of something that's on the back of an envelope. Section 5 deals with overseas voters and requesting replacement ballots if their voters are, or if their ballots are spoiled. Section 6 has to do with ballot requests and instructions to be sent electronically. Section 7 has to do with the study, the use of ranked voting. Section 8 addresses federal ready and absentee ballots, and Section 10 deals with giving emergency powers to facilitate absentee voting by military and those people overseas. I have Secretary Ritchie with me here today to address any technical questions you have in the bill, and I'll put it before you.
Secretary Ritchie.
Chairman Larson, members of the committee, I want to thank you for this opportunity and really from the hearts and the voices of the members of the military, their families that I've been meeting with very regularly for the past few months, I know this is one of the most important things that we will bring forward this year. So I'm very thankful to have this opportunity today. 2 weeks ago, I met with people and the Pentagon officials who are responsible for overseas and military voting, and they were very, very appreciative that we've been able to bring so many of these elements together into this one bill, and I think that keeps Minnesota a real leader in this. But the most important thing is that even in the prior discussion of the earlier bill, it is quite clear that our current system, and we're not seeing any change in the short term, that current system is disenfranchising many of our both military personnel overseas, others who are overseas, our business leaders who are there, some students, people on missionary work, volunteers. But also it's something that is very, very close to the hearts of the families of the members as well. So you've heard a brief outline of the specific points. We've been working very hard with the Guard, with the Reserve, with the active military, with the Pentagon, with members here. We feel like we have a very solid package, and we're very pleased to bring this forward today. Thank you again for this opportunity, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Secretary Ritchie. Senator Rest?
Thank you. I'm trying to understand the impact of the amendment by reinstating on that first line, does not have. And would you explain why the other language is being stricken?
Senator Ropes.
Senator Larson, Senator Rest, are you asking about Section 1, did you say?
No, I'm asking about Rest. Section 2, lines 214 and on, where the language is being struck. Just if you explain why you're doing that. You inserted the driver's license or state ID card number, and then if the voter does not have, and then if the voter does not have.
Yes, Madam Chair.
And then I'm not sure where the amendment took us.
Senator Murdy.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, that seems to be just clearer language. You don't have to, the language that's being stricken about the valid passport or ID card, it's just a shorter way of saying it. And if you don't have the documents, the voter can test to the truthfulness by oath, in effect.
You have to look at Mr.
Okay,
Mr.
so it's. So I just wanted an explanation
Larson,
of that. So it's
Senator
then
Rest.
Striking also then the language on the new language on 2324 and restating the oath language. That's what's happening there.
Secretary Ritchie.
Chairman Larson, Senator Rest. In talking to people, we found that there are just some instances where people don't have these numbers. So we put in the provision for self-oath and to clarify and clean up the language. That was the purpose of the amendment.
Senator Rest.
Thank you. And so, Senator Ropes, would you now explain to me what will be different in a member of the military getting an absentee ballot? How will your bill change this process? Can you tell me what happens now? Why that's what happens now is a problem, and I realize you're trying to streamline it, and then how it's going to be different under this bill.
Senator Ropes.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, thank you very much for your question. Mr. Ritchie.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest.
Ritchie.
Let me review a couple of the things that will make the biggest difference, and then some of the others I think fit and are compatible. The first is that we would allow ballots to be sent to the voters electronically.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Mr. Secretary, I really want to know what happens now and what's going to change?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest.
Secretary Ritchie.
Now, after the primary election and after the results are certified, then the general election ballots can be printed and then mailed. They're put in the mail as fast as people can get them done, and then they go through the postal service of this country or the military into the other country or to the military. They arrive at some point, although not always, they then end up in the hands of the voter. The voter can then can fill in the form, put it back into their mail, and it comes back either via the military postal service or the national and U.S. Postal Service. And I've heard so many stories from particularly county auditors who the day after the election or 1 week after the election or 2 weeks after election, those ballots are arriving. Of course, they are not valid. They are not allowed because they come too late. So by allowing for the ballot to be transmitted electronically, it means that the minute that the results are certified, that ballot can go. So the first half of the journey is eliminated. They can print it out along with printing out the envelope, put it back in, and it can come back. So we've eliminated half of the time, almost half of the time that we're currently taking. So we think this will make a very big difference.
So Mr. Chairman and Mr. Secretary and Senator Ropes, the biggest change is the electronic transmittal of the absentee ballot. Is that correct?
Yes, Chairman Larson, Senator Rest. There are some other provisions that will also speed this up and give some other authority, but that will cut the time in half. We think of that as the most important of those, of all the different things. That will gain us the greatest amount of time.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Senator Erickson Ropes and Secretary Ritchie, I'm glad to see this finally might be happening. I remember when your long-ago predecessor, Secretary Groh, came in and said this was what the Defense Department wanted, the electronic transmission, and we seem to never get there, but it will speed things up, and I'm glad you're getting rid of the witness requirement as well, because I've heard from people overseas who, since the witness was technically supposed to be somebody who was registered to vote here, they have people who, well, I think I might be registered to vote, and nobody checked it anyhow, so it didn't add security, but I think it's a good bill.
Senator Ropes, I believe also that we have signed up to testify Mr. Eric Allness from the Department of Military Affairs.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair. If I could bring the colonel to the table.
Mr. Allness.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I'm Colonel Eric Allness with the Department of Military Affairs. And this initiative provides a timely update to absentee voting as it relates to military members. Military members, and really more importantly, or as importantly, their families, they hold this as a very important right and one that they currently defend. And I'll just comment on a few aspects of this bill that are most important to service members. As was mentioned earlier by Senator Rest and the Secretary, the cut down of time to get it in the hands of the service members is very important so that service members feel that they have time to look at it and vote and have their votes counted. So that is by far the most important thing, is making sure that there's time for them to get the votes and have a count. A second point that I'd want to point out is the change in allowing different forms of ID. If you look at the military ID, there's no number on there anymore as a service number, with the exception of a Social Security number. Now, obviously, we don't want to be throwing Social Security numbers around due to Privacy Act concerns, so the enlarging that area and allowing different forms of identification is very important to service members, and also making sure that their privacy concerns are maintained. And that leads right into the other issue that Senator Rest brought as well, is about the self-certification. That's very helpful. As we talk with soldiers over in Afghanistan or in Iraq, there's a lot of confusion about who is qualified to be a certifying officer to certify that. So this really clarifies it, makes it much more clear for everyone. And helpful across the way. Those are the most important aspects of the bill from a military perspective that clarifies and helps service members make their vote count.
Thank you, Mr. Allness. Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Erickson Ropes, Section 7 says ranked voting study. It's just a simple sentence, and the section says the Secretary of State shall study other states' use of ranked voting to ensure that the votes of military and overseas votes are received prior to the deadline and are counted. What is ranked voting, and what does it have to do with the timeline or deadline for accounting?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ropes. Senator Gerlach, thank you very much for the question, and I'll again let Mr. Ritchie field that one. But I do know this last election cycle, there was considerable news coverage to members who had sent in their ballots and, again, received them too late or after the primaries, and if they were ranked, would be able to factor that in. But, Mr. Ritchie, I'll let you take that.
Chairman Larson.
Senator
Gerlach. In Louisiana, Arkansas, and South Carolina, in the last election, they used a system of what they called ranked voting because their primary and their general are very close, just like ours, so that servicemen were allowed to indicate who they were in favor of in the primary and also to indicate their second and third choice within their party in case the candidate they voted for was not on the final ballot. And I was recently at a meeting of all the secretaries of state, and they were very happy with that system, but they also wanted to move their primary time. You know, in other words, this was a solution of a kind, but it was not going to solve the more fundamental problem, which was the length of time. But finding that those three states had used it successfully was very encouraging to me because it meant that other people faced the same problems we did, and we could be sharing ideas and trying to find ways to speed this up.
Senator Gerlach.
Follow up, then, Mr. Chairman and Secretary Ritchie, then. Well, maybe if we have the June primary, then we won't need to worry about it. But do you need legislation to tell you, to direct you to study what other states are doing? Or can't you just simply, as part of your constitutional obligations of your office, just simply do that? Do we need to put that in, I don't know if this is in statute, or adding language, or is it session law, whichever, but is that necessary, or can't you just do that to do the job?
Senator Ropes.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gerlach, thank you for the question. I think it is a new study that's just being added to this bill. And I would defer to Mr. Ritchie to decide whether it's within the scope of his duties.
Chairman Larson, Senator
Gerlach,
I've been studying it through informal conversations. I was very appreciative that it was in the bill because it stated that this was, you know, something that was important for us to do. And so I feel like it gives me a little more direction and just a little more clarification about it. I'm hopeful that there's some other changes like the primary, but we don't know about that yet. So I would consider this still important to study unless there is, you know, eventually a change in the primary. Even the bill presented today will not help our soldiers in 08, which is when we're going to have maximum number overseas. So I feel like I need a solution for 08. I don't believe I'm going to get help with that with the primary bill. And so this may be part of a solution. I'd like to study it.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Rest.
Yeah, I guess I don't understand also, though, why you would need the legislature to tell you to do that. I mean, it seemed to me you have the authority to do that anyway, and an official authority to do that. I guess I don't think that section's necessary. I'll move to strike Section 7.
Senator Rest moves to strike Section 7 from the bill. Any discussion? Senator Gerlach.
Chairman, I'd just say I wasn't going to make a motion there, but the motion's made, so I would support that. I just think it makes sense. Just we get too bogged down in micromanaging, and then what's the next thing we're going to ask? And, you know, we can let the Secretary study what needs to be done to do the job.
Senator Ropes.
I'll take that as a friendly amendment. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Ropes. Senator Rest moves to delete Section 7 from the bill. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, Secretary Ritchie, I, or Senator Erickson Ropes, the electronic transmission of ballots, I'm wondering why you decided to have them returned in a paper form. And if so, you have the process where it, maybe I'm reading this wrong, but what you have is that I'm overseas, I get the thing faxed to me, I print it out, I vote, put it in the secrecy envelope, mail it back, and person there, it sounds like they open it up, they transfer my votes onto one that'll be read by the scanner. It's not the case.
Secretary Ritchie.
Chairman Lawser, Senator Marty, the two prototypes that I've seen where we've been looking at this, you have a ballot that looks just like your ballot. You fill it in just like you would if you were voting absentee at home, and you you send it. There are some counties beginning now to look at central count of absentees, and so, you know, there may be some other adjustments going forward, but we're putting a very high priority on secrecy of the ballot, and we believe that we can find the systems to do this.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, Secretary Ritchie, I'm not sure you understood my point. On line 4.26, 4.25, after the information on the certificate of voter eligibility has been verified, votes on the ballot must be transferred to a duplicate ballot in the manner provided in such and such section and sealed in the ballot secrecy envelope. And the reason I ask that is if you're going to do it that way, in which case you have earlier on 419 and 420, that the auditor has to take an oath that they're not going to disclose the information. And if so, why don't you allow them to fax it back, which means you'd save both directions. You wouldn't save half the time. You'd save virtually all the time if you're going to lose that secrecy anyway, because the person voting is told that one person out there is going to know how you voted. They're sworn to secrecy, but they're going to know. And if you're going to do that anyway, why have this process where you have to mail it in? Again, I don't know how long it takes from overseas, but you're saving the time one way. Why don't you save the time both ways?
Secretary Ritchie.
Chairman Larson, Senator Marty. There have been efforts in the military in the last couple elections where there have been attempts, and some states have used faxes. Some states have even used Internet for some things. People have felt it's been very insecure. I believe we have work to do to really determine how we can make this the most secure. But what we believe is that by cutting the time in half, we will greatly, if not totally, but greatly increase the likelihood that that mail coming back will happen. Another provision in the bill is for the use of what's called a submarine ballot. It's basically a blank ballot that we would then allow to be used for state. So, in fact, a serviceman or woman overseas could use a submarine ballot the day the primary is over. They could look on the Internet, see who won, fill in the submarine ballot and mail it, and even pick up an extra week or two in that process. So we feel like we're moving in the right direction to find solutions to this problem of the timing. And you know, perhaps there'll come a time when a fax is a really secure way of communications. But for the moment, the two states that I've contacted, Missouri and a western state, I don't remember which one, they felt like it just wasn't secure enough. And you know, if we can buy half the time, I think we're going to do a lot better job.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, Secretary Ritchie, I'm when you're talking about lack of security of the facts, they're still matching the signatures. Is the security that somebody else could receive the facts by accident or?
Yeah, Chairman Larson, Senator okay. Marty, you know, fax machine is just sitting in the auditor's office. Almost anybody is there. You could misdial the number. You know, it's the kind of thing that we don't really have faxes right by auditors in their offices or something like that. There may be some other systems, and people have suggested Internet voting both ways, but we feel like we're a long ways away from really understanding security at that level.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, Secretary Ritchie, if so, I mean, I'm not arguing that this is a big improvement. I just think if somebody is in service overseas and they realize by the time they get the ballot in, it may not make it back in time, and I'm willing to take the chance that somebody may see my fax, it seems to me that would be a decent option to have, so I will urge you to take a look at that. And if not, if you're going to use this language or this procedure, that at least you change the procedure where you transfer it immediately to a duplicate ballot, because then somebody, I mean, you lose the secrecy there. It seems if you have 10 people who voted absentee this way, and you pull them all out, pull the secrecy envelope out the day of the vote once you verify that this person hasn't voted later and that they that's them. You pull them all out and you put them in a stack and you count transfer each one of them, and then you have protected the privacy. So if you're going to do this process, you could avoid that loss of privacy if you change the process. And I'd be happy to talk with you more about this later, but I just think there's got to be a better way to do that. And if you're going to use this process, that you could make this better even.
Secretary Ritchie.
Chairman Larson, Senator Marty, I'd very much appreciate talking with you more about your ideas. The county auditors and all the representatives who've been working on military voting are looking for more ideas as well. And I do think that there are provisions, particularly in the emergency powers, where there could be a way when someone just at the last minute figures out that you know, their ballot didn't come in, that there are some ways around it. I know I did talk to an auditor who said in the old days in Rock County they used to fax around the ballot. So I do know things have happened, you know, in other times at other places when there is an emergency situation. So thank you very much for that offer, and I will definitely take you up on that.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, one final thing, and that is that I only know this because, again, 15 years ago, this when there was first the proposal to do the faxing, it also included people who were in a healthcare facility who were suddenly, I mean, a hospital type of thing. Because if you're traveling in Duluth the weekend before the election and you have a heart attack, auto accident, whatever, you are all of a sudden hospitalized. You have no way to vote. You are planning to be home. You can't now, and unless you can have somebody drive down from Duluth or wherever you are, get an absentee ballot application, drive it up there to you, you fill it in, return it, and so on, there's no way in the world you could vote. And I think allowing it for people who are hospitalized in the last few days before election, whether they're in Duluth or California or wherever, that's something you can do in a different bill if you're not going to do it in this one. But I think it's there's no reason not to treat those folks who are denied their right to vote because of a health accident or something.
Are there further questions for Senator Ropes? Seeing no further questions, Senator Rest. And is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify on Senate File 1218?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rest.
I would move that Senate File 1218 as amended be recommended to pass.
Senator Rest moves that Senate File 1218 be recommended to pass as amended. All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Bill's passed.
As opposed to that jar we passed.
We have next Senator Rummel, Senate File 753. Senator Rummel here. Here she is.
Are we going out of order?
Are you
going
to do no?
The next bill on the agenda was 954, but Senator Higgins is in a committee finishing a bill. Senator Rest, thank you. And so we'll go to Senator Rummel.
Appointing authority.
Senator Rummel, welcome to the Election Subcommittee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. This is another one of those bills that will improve our participation in democracy. The bill you have before you allows cities and counties and school districts to appoint election judges who are not affiliated with major political parties. It also maintains political party balance among the election judges at the polls on Election Day. In addition, it assures judges who are, it assures that election judges affiliated with different political parties are available to assist voters. It responds to the request from constituents who are ineligible to serve as an election judge only because they are not affiliated with a major political party. And finally, it provides relief to local jurisdictions due to the growing difficulty of recruiting qualified election judges to serve at the polls. This is a good and practical bill. It's a simple bill. It is supported by the League of Minnesota Cities, Election Committees, Minnesota Association of County Officers, the Minnesota School Boards Association, the Voter Rights Coalition, and finally the Minnesota League of Women Voters. And I have with me Cindy Reichert,
Mr. Chairman,
from the Senator League Rest. Of
Minnesota
Chairman,
Cities.
Senator Rummel, is it your desire to have the A1 amendment offered to your bill?
Yes, it is. Excuse me for not offering that.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate File Number 753 be amended by the A1 amendment.
Senator Rest moves that the A1 amendment, moves the A1 amendment to Senate File 753. Is there further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Senator Rummel.
I'd like to turn the discussion over to Cindy Reichert, who can give you background and explain the bill further.
Welcome, Ms. Reichert.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Cindy Reichert, the Director of Elections with the City of Minneapolis, and I also serve on the League of Minnesota Cities Elections Task Force. Right now, we are required to ask all of our election judges to declare affiliation with a major party. We currently have three major political parties in our state. And the parties do supply us with lists of potential judges, but the number of judges needed to conduct the election often exceeds the number of names that are supplied by the parties. This puts us in a position where we need to do active recruiting of our election judges just to make sure that the polls are staffed adequately. Now, the average age of our election judges is getting older and older every year. Demands we make on our election judges increase every year. I think it's imperative that we increase our efforts to recruit some younger election judges. And in order to make working at the polls more appealing, we also need to recognize some political trends and design our requirements for serving as a judge to match the reality of the environment that we're in. Younger people seem generally more reluctant to declare a party affiliation. Many prefer to decline being an election judge rather than make a false declaration or what they feel is a false declaration on their application. Most cities also employ student to trainee election judges for each election, and very few students are prepared at age 18 to make a declaration of their party affiliation. Now, the intent of requiring this affiliation is to provide oversight on some of the election procedures, certainly not all of the procedures in the polling place. Only some specifically require two judges of different political parties to perform the action. Now, what this legislation does is it retains the requirement that at least two persons in each polling place are there and affiliated with a party, and it also requires party balance to be maintained for those judges who do declare an affiliation. The beauty of this solution is that it keeps those existing provisions intact, but it does expand opportunities for persons with no specific party affiliation or perhaps a minor party to participate in the election process. Now, most election judges are motivated through a sense of civic responsibility rather than a party loyalty, and allowing citizens to serve without party affiliation will strengthen our election system. It'll widen the pool of qualified applicants. I think passage of this bill will also demonstrate the legislature's commitment to public participation in the election process, and I think it will support our youth as they grow into engaged citizens. So I'd be willing to answer any of the questions that you have. I've had experience not just in a large city, but also in St. Louis Park, conducting elections in a suburban area. I don't believe this is just a city or a metro issue. This is statewide, but I'd be happy to answer your questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Reichert. Any questions? Senator Rest.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Rummel or Ms. Reichert, the current law does not state how many election judges are needed. Is it the case that every single precinct has, when they are conducting an election, has four. Is there no place where we vote in Minnesota where there are less than four election judges?
I'll handle that, Madam Chair. There is a provision in statute that if you have electronic equipment, you're required to have four judges. A hand count, you're only required to have three. However, most polling places staff significantly higher than the minimum number. Here in Minneapolis, we would do 12 to 15 perhaps on a day.
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Rummel or Ms. Reichert, if some other place in the law it states that you only need three election judges, don't you need to make an amendment to that section of the law, too, to say that you need four election judges minimum? And if not, why not?
Senator Rummel, Ms. Reichert.
Madam Chair, I believe that is covered in a separate statute, a separate area of statutes, and I don't know the number right now, but the number of judges required to conduct an election is contained in statute already, but we're allowed to, of course, hire more than that minimum number.
I know, but Mr. Chairman, Ms. Reichert, this says that Oh, it's not two. It's not two apiece. It's all. It's could be one. It could be as few as two.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. So it just means one. See, I'm trying to. I want to make sure I'm not confused.
Mr. Chair, Senator Wright.
Election. It's not two judges from apiece from each party. It's just that there has to be one Democrat and one Republican, and then any others that are required, regardless, don't have to have an affiliation. Is that
that's what this bill
correct?
Says?
Now the,
yes.
Amendment. Thank you.
The purpose of that is to maintain.
No, I understand
that we have people on each party.
I was reading it incorrectly.
Are there further questions? We have also have Joe Mansky, Director of Elections from the City of St. Paul and Ramsey County. That is going to pass, it appears, and Kent Sulem from the Minnesota Association of Townships has indicated a desire to testify. Mr. Sulem's coming forward. Mr. Sulem.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, Kent Sulem with the Minnesota Association of Townships, and thank you for the opportunity to testify in strong support of this bill. This we'd actually like to see it go even further, and maybe in time we'll be able to do that by saying that you don't need party affiliation at all when it's a nonpartisan race, such as our township elections. But at least we do strongly support this bill as amended. The party lists that currently come out to much of the rural areas, with all due respect to the major parties, are meaningless. They come out. We've had town officers who have never missed a precinct caucus. And they can't get on the voter election judge list, no matter how many times they go and say, I'd love to be a judge. They never make it onto the party list. I get several calls a year from our members asking at time of appointment saying, well, the list we received contains more dead people than live people. How do we appoint them from this list? under the current law, having this mandate that you have to use the list is very problematic in the rural areas. And then when you get a broader list, we actually had a situation a couple years ago where in the far northwest corner, they had people on the list from the far southeast corner. They were obligated to contact those people. And if somebody said yes, they had to arrange to pay for them to drive from the far southeast to the far northwest to serve as an election judge. This bill gives the flexibility that's needed to actually make good, solid elections in a prudent manner. So we strongly support its passage.
Thank you, Mr. Sulem. Any further comments, Senator Rummel?
Not right now, Chair.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, we were just discussing the language on line 114 about the two election judges must be affiliated with a major political party. As the council pointed out, that we do have the party balance thing where you can't have more than half from any one major political party. But the trouble is if you have six judges in a precinct and you have four nonpartisan, you could have two Democrats or two Republicans here. And I don't think that's what we want. I think we want to have it where it's at least two judges who are affiliated with a major political party, and maybe Senator Rest's idea or Senate Counsel has a better one, but affiliated with a different major political party, because that would require there to be at least two from a major party, and they'd have to be from a different one. But maybe we can defer to Senate Counsel if he's got some ideas.
Mr. Watson, do you have an idea for us?
Mr. Chairman, I might suggest on page 1, line 14 of the amendment, delete A and insert different, and delete party and insert parties.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move that.
Senator Rest moves that on line 14, delete A and insert different, and delete party and insert parties. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Is there further discussion? Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate file 753 as amended be recommended.
Senator Ress has made a motion. Ahead of that, I want to just see if there's anyone else in the audience that desires to testify on this bill. Not seeing anyone coming forward, Senator Rest renews her motion. that Senate File 753, as amended, be recommended to pass. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Bill is passed.
Thank you,
Senator
Mr.
Rummel.
Chair.
Senator Higgins. Next on the agenda is Senate File 954. Senator Higgins.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for accommodating my goofy schedule today. We have Senate File 954. I have with me C. Scott Cooper.
Senator Higgins.
Go through the bill, but I think we have an A1 amendment.
We have an A1 amendment that's being passed out.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rest.
I move adoption of the A1 amendment.
Senator Rest moves adoption of the A1 amendment. And that amendment will get the bill in the shape that the author wishes.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Senator Rest moves the A1 amendment. Is there any discussion? Does everyone have the amendment? You get the bill in the shape the author wishes. The A1 amendment is moved. All those in favor say aye.
Not that much. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The A1 amendment is adopted. Senator Higgins.
Go ahead. Give mine away.
Mr. Cooper, excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Scott Cooper, and I'm here today representing the Minnesota Voting Rights Coalition, which is an alliance of the state's leading civic organizations working in a nonpartisan way to promote democracy and civic engagement. And some of the members of our coalition include the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits, the League of Women Voters, the Disability Law Center, the Joint Religious Legislative Coalition. There are about 2 dozen groups involved. And we try to work closely with both the Secretary of State's office and the local elections officials to improve our election systems. This bill would expand opportunities for Election Day registration and simplify Election Day registration in some ways. I'd like to just quickly walk through the bill. We know you have a packed agenda today. We don't intend to take up your time with a lot of testimony. We do have several coalition partners here to answer questions if there are things that are specific to their areas of expertise, but we're not going to ask anyone else to come up and testify today unless you have questions. Section 1 deals with the current practice of colleges and universities providing lists of students, mostly students who live in on-campus housing, to the counties for the purpose of having those lists available at the polling place as a way to prove that those students, in fact, do live at those addresses. We propose here in Section 1 expanding that to ask the colleges and universities to provide lists of all their students with their addresses. And the Secretary of State's office has kindly agreed to act as a clearinghouse for this process so that the list would come to them. They would identify by precinct where all the students actually fall so that that is not up to the colleges and universities to determine, and then would distribute those lists out to the counties.
Mr. Cooper, in the Section 1, it identifies colleges who would not consider their student list to be public information. What is the situation in Minnesota as it relates to that? Do you know?
In discussions in past years on this subject, most of the colleges and universities have been agreeable to sharing their list for this purpose, to help their students be registered or to register on Election Day. Some had concerns about sharing their lists and felt that it was necessary to request the waiver, and so we thought we should allow for that.
Senator Rest.
Thank you, and appreciate you going section by section. And so what problem does this solve?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest.
The first section.
Yes. What we try to do is not think up ways to change the system just for the sake of changing them. We work at the grassroots every election cycle trying to register people and identify what some of the barriers are and then try to bring them here with solutions. So one of the problems that has arisen is that when you go out and are trying to do a voter registration drive or do turnout on Election Day on college campuses, it's sometimes very confusing to not know what to tell the students about what sort of form of ID they have to take with them to the polling place if they may not have somebody who can vouch for them, may not have an ID with their current address. Being able to say to all of the students that, in fact, they are on a student housing list and will be able to show up at the polling place and their They won't have to show proof of residence then. Simplifies turnout on college campuses.
So, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rest.
So this list is not being made available publicly at all.
No, only to election judges.
Only at the
Polling
at the precinct, only on election day.
Yes.
As a verification that the student is actually in a residential situation at that higher education institution.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, that is correct.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Cooper.
Section 2 deals with some of the forms of ID that can be used for Election Day registration. I think the definitions here have just been rearranged to clarify them. The changes here that I would highlight for you from the current system are the use of a driver's license or identification card from another state, which in the past has not been permissible, for the purposes only of proving identity, obviously not of proving residence. So someone who has moved to the state does not have yet a Minnesota driver's license but is otherwise eligible to vote should be able to use that ID to prove that they are who they say they are, just as you can use an ID for that purpose at any bar in Minnesota. And that's something that the local elections officials have said that they were agreeable to. And that has been a problem in the past. That's come up on our election hotline. People have called in and said, "Hey, I have proof that that my residence is such and such, but I the only proof I have that I am who I say I am is my driver's license from Wisconsin, where I used to live. Can I use that?" And unfortunately, we've had to say no in the past. Another change here is the use of a high school ID. It has been college, university, or other post-secondary educational institution in the past. We added high school ID here. This is something that's permissible under HAVA. We were trying to add as many of the HAVA allowable IDs as seemed practical and seemed doable to the local elections officials. Again, that would be for the purpose of proving identity only. So someone who has just turned 18 and is eligible to vote may not have a driver's license or a Minnesota ID, but may very well have a photo ID from their high school.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rest.
I'm trying to follow. I appreciate what you just said, Mr. Cooper, but I'm trying to follow the amendment and the changes that you're making there. If you could go back and we've adopted it, but if you could go back and explain why you wanted to change on rewrite that. I guess it's rewriting number 5. Is that correct?
Senator Higgins. Mr. Cooper.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, will you point us to where you're talking about?
I'm looking at line 14 on the amendment,
line
13, where on page 3 you delete lines 20 to 35,
okay.
And
Mr.
insert
Chair,
a new 5, and I'm trying to read it fast enough to see what's different.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, we're only on page 2, so you're a little ahead of us in the amendment. We're on page 2 of the bill, and that's on page 3. We haven't gotten there yet to tell you what that's all about.
Okay.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, I'm sorry, I wasn't clear where I was. I was talking about the changes that are in the bill, not the amendment.
I'm sorry. I thought you were talking about the amendment.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Mr. Cooper, you're in Section 2, isn't that correct?
Yeah.
In Section 2 of the bill, yes.
Page 2.
Please proceed.
15. Here we might want to talk about this amendment.
We also wanted to clarify in that same section, Section 2, on page 2, line 15, that these are all Minnesota IDs. That's a correction being made in the author's amendment.
Okay. Mr. Cooper?
Delete 30 and 30.
On page 2 in line 30 and 31, we had proposed Social Security statement as proof of residence. We are not going to offer that. There were concerns about privacy there and about this being one more thing that election judges have to learn to identify and use. So we're withdrawing that in the author's amendment. At the bottom of page 2 on the bill, utility bill, this is very similar to current practice in that our understanding is that satellite television bills have been allowed in addition to cable television bills and others, but we wanted to clarify that in the law because it was not clear that that is a permissible utility bill. So that would be the expansion there. On page 3 and line 8, we again remove Social Security statement or other government document. That is language that HAVA allows. We are not actually requesting that change at this time, and the author's amendment removes that language. So it would just be the current utility bill, and then we add in lease. This is another thing which has come up frequently in practice where people say, I recently moved, I don't have a new ID, and I don't know my neighbors, so they can't vouch for me, but I do have a lease. Shouldn't that be acceptable proof of my current address? There have been concerns raised in the past by local elections officials that it would be difficult for election judges to determine what is a true lease and what is not. In conversations about this bill over the past weeks, it seems like those we've gone beyond those concerns, and people believe it is something we can deal with. Mr. Chairman, as we are looking at the author's amendment, many of the rest of these changes just deal with renumbering. And then we are inserting one new concept here that was not in the original bill. The author's amendment adds in language which on page 3, which would remove the limit on the number of people for whom an individual can vouch. That limit was put into law in the last couple years. There had never been a limit in the past. The new limit is 15, and we are proposing that we remove that. We have not heard of any concerns that there was fraudulent vouching. There have been no concerns about that. There have been problems where someone could vouch for more than 15 people in a close-knit community or perhaps in a high-rise building where you have a lot of new citizens and you have someone who is very familiar with the community, has been active in that building and knows lots of people, could vouch for them and is currently limited to 15. The other problem here is that we've heard from local elections officials that it is a burden to keep this list. This is just one more thing for the election judges to keep track of, to keep a list of how many people someone vouches for.
And Senator Higgins, Mr. Cooper, this might be a question for counsel, but what do we require of election judges as it relates to the in terms of information as it relates to the person who is vouching for someone in terms of proof of their residency and their knowledge of that person's residency?
In order to be able to vouch for someone, you must be previously registered
in that precinct.
Or you may register that day, but not by vouching. So you can't have someone vouch for you and then vouch for someone else. So you could show your form of ID and register, and then you could vouch for someone else.
And then also, when you vouch for someone, you sign a form saying that you know that person and are vouching for them.
Senator Rust.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Higgins, where is that in the law? It looks
well,
like
it's just always the way it's been.
Taking out the language
16 and of 17 of the amendment.
15, the number of 15, but then it looks like later on there was a in language that you're taking out the requirement that somebody sign something. So is that somewhere else in the law that they have to do that, or am I once again
Senator,
reading too fast?
Senator Rest, I think if you look on the author's amendment on lines 16 and 17, the language that requires that the person sign an oath in the presence,
okay,
the presence,
right,
of,
yeah,
the elections judge.
Thank you.
Mr. Cooper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On page 4, on line 4.7, line 7 of page 4, we remove a requirement, which is actually also a new concept. It was put in law in the last couple years. We have allowed residential facilities to designate who their staff are so that those staff, even if they don't live in that precinct, can then go and vouch for residents of that facility. Unfortunately, it hasn't worked out very well in practice because residential facilities, as you can imagine, have many other things to do and have not been turning in this list of all of their employees to the county auditor 20 days before the election, and therefore their employees can't go and vouch for their residents. So we thought that it would be more sensible to remove the requirement that they turn the list in 20 days ahead of time and simply establish that the employees can prove employment by bringing in, say, an ID or a letter from the employer stating that they work there, and then they would be able to vouch for residents of that facility. On page 5 of the bill, subdivision 3A, and in section 3, it changes subdivision 3A. A requirement was recently put into law that challengers must both be a resident of Minnesota and make their challenge based on personal knowledge. We believe that that's a great idea. Unfortunately, there was never any requirement put into law that they show that they are a resident of Minnesota. So we would simply like them to, when they arrive at the polling place, show the election judge not only their letter from their party designating them as a challenger, but also their ID or any other form of ID that would be allowed on the other side to vote to prove that they are in fact a resident and eligible to be a challenger. We would also like them to take an oath stating that they understand the rules of challenging, what their role is in the process. We believe that this will help ensure that people are actually useful in the polling place, cooperative with the election judges, and that they are fulfilling their unique role as challengers and not being an obstacle to people voting or a barrier to election judges doing their jobs. You'll see in the author's amendment that we moved that from where it is in the bill to a different section. In the bill, it appears that what we would like is for the challengers to take that oath every time they make a challenge. That's not the case. The author's amendment fixes that so that they would simply take the oath at the time that they appear and show their ID. They would take the oath once.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Cooper. Mr. Watson.
Mr. Chairman, in looking at that language, I see a mistake that I made on lines 35 and 36 of the amendment. It says that the laws as described in this section and in section 204C.07, but this is being coded into 204C.07. In the bill as introduced, that was coded in 204C.12, but having moved it into 07, I think it would be appropriate to delete "and in section 204C.07.
Senator Rest, would you make that motion?
Yes. Do we need the comma after challengers, Mr. Watson, in that same line?
Mr. Watson.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, I think that the requirements are for both challenges and challengers. It's not just challengers as described in this section.
Okay.
It's challenge.
Thank
challenges.
You. I would move to on line 135 of the amendment to delete everything after the word section and then to delete line 36.
Senator Rest moves to amend by deleting on 1.35 everything after the word section and deleting 1.36. Is there any discussion? All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're on discussion on the bill.
We are on the bill.
I have a couple of things. Mr. Cooper, you did I think a good job of explaining the trees, but I want to try to see the forest for a moment here, and specifically on the student section, the higher ed part about schools submitting lists. And I don't think I heard kind of a higher altitude, what is this trying to do? So what is, I mean, Senator Rest asked the question, what problem is this trying to solve? I did not glean a clear, you know, answer to that. And maybe you did. I didn't pick up on that, what the actual answer was. So I'm wondering, can you tell me specifically on the section dealing with the students, what is the problem that it's trying to solve?
Mr. Chairman, I wonder if I could explain how I understood it, and then if I'm wrong, then he can correct it. That right now, some students don't know that they would be eligible, and so by telling them that if they go to the precinct polling place, by being living in a residence hall at that university or institution. The election judges would be able to tell them. So someone who's trying to register someone to vote on a campus could just say, if you live in a residence hall, they'll have your name on a list at the polls, and you can register there. That's rather than them not knowing.
Or coming, having to get a voucher.
Or having to get someone to vouch for them.
How was that, Mr. Cooper?
Mr. Chairman and Senators Rest and Gerlach, that is true. That is a good explanation of that. If I could just back up a little bit farther to more forest, even. I think the concept between having the list to begin with was that students are in a position often where they may not have any form of ID that shows their address, which obviously they would be able to use on its own to register to vote. They may just have a student ID, which they could use to prove their identity. They may not have a utility bill to show what their residence is, because they may live with many roommates or they may live in a dorm. And so this list was created as a way for them to be able to prove their residence, because the college vouches that, in fact, they do live at that address. And what we're trying to do in the bill is simply improve that by allowing for more students to use that system, and that would include students who live off campus. And to get away from the ambiguity we have right now, where some students would be on the list and some students would not, which leads to the confusion that Senator Rest just talked about.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chairman,
Senator Gerlach.
Mr. Cooper, so this is not an automatic registration. You're saying this is providing a list to substitute for the vouching.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gerlach, that is correct.
Okay. All right.
Senator Gerlach.
Okay. Well, then that helps me there. Okay. Mr. Chairman, I do have a question, potentially an amendment here. We're striking the language about the limit of 15 for vouching. And I'm trying to recall, I wasn't on the committee, but I believe that you are correct, Mr. Cooper, that this was put into law just a couple of years ago, relatively recently, and that it was not without controversy, and it was not, I think it was designed around the notion that if someone's vouching for a extraordinarily large number of people, this is not just a neighbor or a friend or something, but an extraordinarily large number of people, that it stretches credulity, is that a word? That they actually have personal knowledge of all of, you know, these individuals and such. And so I think I remember when that was put in there, and I supported that, putting that in there. I thought that was very reasonable. You're striking that now here, and the response or the rationale for why that was being stricken, I felt that was weak. I didn't quite feel compelled that, oh, you're right, we should undo what we just did a couple of years ago. And so Can you offer me either a stronger explanation or then, you know, and if not, I mean, I may move to just strike the stricken language and restore the language. But what in your experience is finding where that's somehow being a problem? Do you know of any case that someone has said, oh, I've hit 15, but I still have more I want to vouch for? Darn law. I mean, has that happened?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gerlach, yes, we do know of a few cases where that has happened. There were a couple cases of individuals in Duluth, and there was at least one case in Minneapolis where people were trying to help register people to vote. They did have personal knowledge, and they were willing to swear the oath that you swear when you vouch, that they had personal knowledge that these people lived where they said they lived, and they were unable to do more than 15. And so that's the problem that we are trying to address. An example, Mr. Chairman, if I may.
Mr. Cooper.
Senator Gerlach, one example I I may have glossed over too quickly before, but one example that comes to mind is someone who is in the Somali community and was a fairly new citizen and was helping other people who in their community who also lived in a high-rise in Minneapolis that they lived in, trying to help register those people to vote. Obviously, pre-registration would be the preferred thing here, but some people who had become citizens and eligible to vote later on in the year, that person then tried to vouch for on election day, saying, yes, I was at the naturalization ceremony with them. They are eligible to vote, and I know where they live because they live in my high-rise building. And did run into the limit of 15. I think that's a good example where someone may have intimate knowledge of the people who live in their precinct.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Gerlach.
I guess I feel that, I mean, the cases where that you might run into that limit versus kind of the integrity of the system, I think on balance, I would feel much more comfortable if we had a limit rather than saying no limit at all. Going back to the way it was, so I would make a motion. I would like to move that. I guess it's on the author's amendment, the A1 amendment, lines 18 through 29. I believe is the section I'm after, which I would move that language be the stricken language be reinstated.
Senator Gerlach moves to reinstate the stricken language on the author's amendment on line 1.19. Through 1.29.
Mr. Chairman, I don't think I need to speak to it. I think I've explained.
Thank you, Senator. Is there any discussion? Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, I'd hope that you would vote against this amendment. I think as we are finding the new Minnesotans, the immigrant community, becoming citizens, we find those close-knit communities especially will everybody knows everybody, and yet if we take this provision away, as Mr. Cooper said, you know, you can't go and be vouched for and then turn around and vouch for somebody else. We don't allow that. And there may be, as more and more people in the immigrant communities become citizens, it won't be so necessary to have one person vouch for many. But right now, where people are becoming citizens gradually, there still, I think, is a compelling reason to have somebody who knows lots of folks in the community be able to vouch for lots of folks.
Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree with Senator Higgins. I think the language, Senator Gerlach, on 18 and 19 in the amendment, which is, restating the current law and then just striking the rest of it, is enough protection of somebody who's been vouched for and not being able to turn around and vouch for others for the integrity of vouching. I'm going to vote against your amendment.
Plus, Mr. Chair, if I could,
Senator Higgins,
the voucher has to swear an oath that what he's doing is, if you're looking at the issue of fraud, I think signing that oath, it's a serious, it's your basic crime if you lie on that oath. And as far as I know, people take that seriously. So. If you're trying to get at fraud, I don't think it's there. And I would urge you to vote against this amendment.
Any further discussion? Senator Gerlach moves. Senator Gerlach's motion is before us. All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
No. The motion does not prevail. Amendment is not adopted. Are there further additional testifiers, Senator Higgins?
No, Mr. Chair.
My reason.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Rest.
I would move that Senate file 954 as amended be recommended to pass.
Senator Rest moves that Senate file 954 as amended be recommended to pass. Before we take the vote on that, first of all, Mr. Watson.
Mr. Chairman, I didn't fix up that amendment
Okay, Mr. Watson.
We could revisit that again. It turns out that the requirements governing or the laws governing challenges are in section 204C.12, not in 07, so we need to refer to that. And the laws governing challengers are in both 204C.07 and 204C.12. So if we were to rewrite it to put them in statutory order, it would say a challenger must state under oath that the challenger understands and will abide by the laws and rules governing challengers as described in this section and in section 204C.12 and challenges to voters as described in section 204C.12.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rest.
First of all, I would like to reconsider the motion by which we adopted the previous amendment.
Senator Rest moves a reconsideration of the motion by which we previously adopted the amendment. Those in favor of that motion, say aye.
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 Opposed? That motion prevails. Senator Rest.
And then I would withdraw that amendment and offer the amendment that follows the language that was just read to us by Mr. Watson.
Senator Rest withdraws the previous amendment. Do members have the amendment that Mr. Watson has read to us? Seeing that we do, the motion, Senator Rest's motion is to adopt the amendment, the oral amendment, as relayed to us by Mr. Watson. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Are there others in the audience that would are interested in testifying on this bill? Seeing no one coming forward, Senator Rest.
I would move that, again, renew my motion that Senate File 954 is amended be recommended to pass.
Senator Rest moves that Senate File 954 as amended be recommended to pass. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. The bill is passed.
Thank you very much.
Senator Olson is next on the agenda with Senate File 124. And then, Senator Olson, I understand you'll also be presenting Senate File 1098 for Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm very pleased to be here on behalf of Senate File 124. Before we begin, I believe you have a copy of the A1 author's amendment, which puts the bill in the form it would have, as I'd like to have it, which I'd like it to have as we proceed.
Thank you, Senator Olson. The A1 amendment is being passed out, which does put the bill in the shape that the author would like it to be in. Wait till everyone gets the amendment. Senator Rest. I'm just waiting until everyone has the amendment.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rest.
I'm going to move the A1 amendment, but since it is so long, I'm going to ask the author to, usually we would just adopt it, but it's a very long amendment and we have not seen it. Well, would you just explain what the differences are, and then we can adopt it to get the bill in the shape that you want?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, basically this is a delete-all amendment, and the significant change made was that with respect to appointing the ability to appoint someone to fill out a term as a county commissioner, the county board would have the option whether to choose to have a special election or to make the appointment. The initial bill required an appointment, and this gives the county board the option.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Senator Rest.
Renew my motion to adopt the A1 amendment.
Senator Rest moves adoption of the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill essentially has two parts. The first part is intended to correct a problem that occurs when someone passes away or becomes incapable of fulfilling their job as a county commissioner. And what it does is if it's within the second 2 years of an elected term, it allows the county board to make a decision to appoint a person to fill the term. It also changes from 60 days to 90 days the amount of time within which special election would have to occur, primarily because with the time it takes for advertising and fulfilling the requirements for a special election, oftentimes this is happening before someone is even in some cases before the person has even been buried, and it becomes very hurtful to the people involved. The second part of the amendment, I believe, or the second part of the bill has been through this committee before and has been approved in the past. Basically, what this does is not require the county board to have to come down here, as I am with my second Senate file 1098, and ask for your permission to approve a decision to appoint rather than to elect certain county positions. And with that, I have with me here today Joe Matthews from the Association of Minnesota Counties, who will testify more specifically about the bill. Sharon Anderson, a Cass County auditor, who is also, I think you have a copy of a letter from her, who that discusses a specific situation that arose in Cass County that this bill is meant to address. And also Pat Silberg, who is here with Grant County, Maco, who has some concerns about the second portion of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Matthews.
My name is Joe Matthews. I'm with the Association of Minnesota County. And I'll just quickly run through the author's amendment and kind of explain a little bit, or the bill now that it's in the correct form. The first section, as the Senator mentioned, addresses the timing issue. We've had situations, Steele County last September, a county commissioner passed away, and he passed away on the 1st of September. And due to current statute, the county board actually had to meet, I think it was September 5th or 6th, to have an emergency meeting to get the process in motion to have a special election to fill that position. As the bill was originally drafted, it was mentioned that it was required that they appoint our county commissioners in the position of AMC, is that we'd like to be able to have a special election. We do need the change from 60 to 90 days to allow enough time so that folks can grieve properly before they have to start noticing the vacancy and before candidates for that office have to begin petitioning and filing for office and things like that. The second section simply explains that the use of appointment to fill that seat is restricted. You can't appoint if the vacancy occurs before the filing period for the general election. You also cannot appoint if the period to be served is more than 2 years. We think that makes a lot of sense. Obviously, our folks' preference, again, is to have elections, not appoint. So we think that is good language there. Sections 3 through the rest of the bill really get to the issue of appointing county row officers. This is the auditor, the treasurer, and the recorder. You'll see that some of these sections look similar. There's obviously a few different statutes that have to be referenced. But in Section 5, you can see language. It's on page 3, I believe, which explains the process that the county board would have to use in the event that they wanted to make those offices appointed. This language is modeled after many of the bills that you've seen before you for specific counties and also for a statewide proposal that was introduced, I believe, last year. And it does offer, we feel, significant protections for the public to make sure that they're aware of the change and also to give them a chance to provide feedback. It does require 80% of the county board to vote in affirmative in support of the change from making a position elected to appointed. It also requires 2 public notices over the period of, you know, once each of 2 weeks. It also allows for the public to be, it actually requires that the county board have a hearing to allow public input. And one of the changes from the original bill to this bill was some technical clarifying language that the public has 30 days from the time at which they're given the chance to provide feedback to gather their petitions. The original language said that they had 30 days from the time of the second notice. We thought it made more sense if they didn't start the petition process until they had an indication as to whether or not the county board might actually move forward with something like this. finally, if the county board does adopt a resolution to go this direction, the public, again, can file a petition requesting that there be a countywide referendum, and that has been used in the past. In fact, I believe there's three counties in the past that have where folks have filed a petition and the referendum did fail. But there's a number of other counties that have gone through this process, and there either has or has not been a referendum, but they have made role officers appointed, including many metro counties and many rural counties. So this isn't just a geographic area. It's not a large county, small county issue. From time to time, we feel that all counties might find themselves in a situation where they feel that it's more beneficial to the citizens to have an appointed as opposed to elected person serving in those positions. And we feel, as the Association of Minnesota Counties, that that decision should be made on the local level by the county board and by the people of that county as opposed to the state legislature. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, you really greatly expanded your bill here. I'm not sure I don't support it, but I wish we had known that you were going to be doing that. We might have had more testimony on that. At least that's what it seems to me.
Mr. Chair.
In places where this has been done before, has 10% been the number of voters that have been required on the petition?
I believe that's correct, Senator Rest, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Ms. Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I did submit to you...
Ms. Anderson, if you could state your name for the record, please.
Sharon
Thank
Anderson,
you.
Cass County Auditor Treasurer. I did submit to you a written statement of the background of how the first portion of this bill evolved originally with the death of one of our county commissioners in 2002. I won't reread what I submitted to you in writing. Mr. Matthews also alluded to a situation in Steele County and a neighboring county of ours in the north part of the state has experienced this a number of times in the last several years. So really, I think, just to boil it down in essence, our county board, and I am just speaking to the addition of Subdivision 1A, to Minnesota Statute 375.101 today. I won't be addressing the rest of the bill, but certainly this is a high priority for our county commission to see some discretion at the local level on how we fill that vacancy until we bridge the gap to the next regular election. And that really is, in essence, what Subdivision 1A does. I think I would certainly be open to answering any questions. I personally think, and you'll hear further testimony on this from Mrs. Soberg in a few moments, the appointment of the row officers, to my way of thinking, it's certainly a more controversial issue. My county has been trying to take a swing at this Subdivision 1A. I think this is our fifth time at bat since the death of Commissioner Witham. So I would urge you to consider this portion of the bill, regardless of what happens in your debate on the rest of that. And thank you for the opportunity to address you this afternoon. Be happy to take any questions that you have.
Thank you, Ms. Anderson. Senator Olson, you had an additional testifier. Is that correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chair. I believe there's a Pat Soberg would like to testify at this point.
I'd ask all witnesses to sign in on the sign in there, and also state your name for the record.
Okay, my name is Pat Soberg, and I'm the Grand County Treasurer from Elba Lake, Minnesota.
Thank you. Proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members of this committee, thank you for hearing us today. And due to the reports of weather, we would have had more individuals here to support this our position. However, they chose to stay where it's probably safe. Today I speak as a representative of the Minnesota Association of County Officers, which is made up of the auditors, treasurers, and recorders from around the state. It is the position of this organization to oppose legislation that would eliminate the election of these offices and allow appointment by an 80% vote of the County Board of Commissioners in each county. Minnesota Statute 375A already allows counties to restructure local government and to fit the needs for each specific county. But what 375A has allowed for that Senate File 124, Sections 3 through 5, and its companion in the House 269 doesn't, is the vote of the people. The big push for appointment and combination of offices actually began in the mid-1980s when concerns of county commissioners were raised regarding the qualifications of individuals who had chose to run for these positions. There was an indication that the people who did run were not qualified, although they were still qualified to elect a county commissioner, a state legislator, a federal legislator, president of the United States, our state governor. And so there was this perception that these three positions are filled by a popularity vote. MACO recognized the need for training for individuals who did fill these positions, and we developed a first-time-ever training program for newly elected auditors, treasurers, and individuals who filled our deputy positions. When they finished the course, a test was administered by the Department of Revenue, and whoever passed it became a certified auditor and treasurer. At this time, the county recorders had already implemented an educational program through an accredited facility to meet the needs of their offices. To remain certified in these programs, each participant, each county auditor, treasurer, and recorder must attend a specific amount of training designed specifically for our associations through accredited facilities like we were through the University of Minnesota Carlson School of Business at one time. More recently, we have gone through Century College. As the needs of the offices have changed, we've continued to develop courses and training to meet these needs not only for seasoned officials, but for all the newly elected individuals. Because county government is constantly changing and adding new challenges to our positions, we continue to be diligent in providing education and training opportunities for all of our members. Most recently, a program was developed specifically for tax calculation. And a select group of individuals from our associations were chosen to participate, which ranged from individuals elected during this last general election in 2006, and they had never been in public office. And they also had people who were as far into their career as an elected auditor, treasurer, recorder, where they may be even looking at PERA for retirement purposes. The purpose behind the diversity of the test was to test the effectiveness of our program for meeting the needs of members of our associations of MACO, along with the Department of Revenue. We have also developed a detailed manual, for addressing the issue of our administration of tax and tax forfeiture process. Recorders have taken on a tremendous task of implementing electronic recording, which has required countless hours of training and testing, not only the system, but ensuring that all the legal requirements have been met. As an association, we feel we have been diligent in creating and maintaining opportunities of education for anyone who's elected into these positions. However, we are faced with another grave concern, and that is the appointment process. Democracy is about people having choices, and yet these bills do exactly the opposite of what a democracy intended. Voters in our counties are in jeopardy of losing the right to vote for the kind of government they prefer, and they don't even know it if this passes. The only recourse that these voters do have is a restrictive amount of time to get the required signatures on a petition that would require a ballot vote. For whatever reason county commissioners have for wanting these positions appointed instead of elected, they should not be hesitant to sell this idea on its own merits to the public first and then allow voters to make an informed choice on whether this is an acceptable form of government. If the commissioners' reasons are qualified individuals, I believe our associations have gone over the top to ensure Minnesota residents that we have these three positions qualified. County commissioners are elected to manage the budget and make policies, not change the type of government. There are three branches of government: legislative, executive, and judicial. When part of the executive branch is eliminated, this balance is thrown off. If this balance of power is changed, the type of government is changed. If these positions become appointed, who will be able to stand up and question or challenge county policy or actions taken by the county board without fear of losing their job? Auditors, recorders, and treasurers are elected countywide. We have no policy, we have no policy-making authority. We are not subject to special interest areas, and we do not set budgets. And yet, to maintain a checks and balances within the county government, there have to be individuals who hold a position in a manner that they do not have to fear losing their job. Appointment will move government one more step away from the voters. Local, state, and federal governments has launched a tremendous campaign in the last 5 years to get voters involved, and yet we are looking at two bills that do exactly the opposite. For centuries, we have fought wars and lost countless lives to maintain that freedom to vote and to live in a democratic society. If we think the public doesn't care about losing their vote, let's put it on a ballot, and we will find out differently. Each of our offices is a public office, and we are elected by the public to run it in the most efficient manner in keeping with the best interests of the county. In all honesty, there are individuals in our own association who would rather be appointed so that they do not have to run every 4 years and risk losing their jobs. I've heard them say it. I have also heard others say that if they were appointed, they could make more money. Okay, and yet they have no desire to see their office become appointed unless it is the vote or the voice of the voters that make that change. So MACO supports Minnesota Statutes 375A, which allows counties to change their government structure, but only after the public is informed, involved in the process, and allowed to vote their choice. I ask you today, please, to send a message to those who continually come to the legislature with this issue, that it is a local issue, it should be dealt with on the local level, and to use 375A, which was put into law to protect the rights of the people.
Thank you, Ms. Solberg. An announcement for those in the audience, just so if you happen to be waiting for two of the bills that are on our agenda in that Senate file, 1297, which is the automatic voting registration bill, and Senate file 1366 of Senator Clark. Given our time frame this evening, those bills will not be heard this evening. And so if you're waiting here for either of those, we want to give you that information. Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, are they going to be heard on Friday then, Friday afternoon?
Senator Pappas, that's our intention. Okay. That's right.
I think that's good to tell you.
Good point. Absolutely.
Mr. Chair, I would like to thank Ms. Solberg for her testimony, and I think affirm to her that all of those here, including myself, really appreciate the work that the auditors, treasurers, and county recorders do on behalf of our county, and that there's certainly nothing in this bill that's intended to demean or diminish the importance of their jobs. But just briefly, for clarification purposes, if time allows, I would appreciate it if you would allow Mr. Matthews just a few minutes to respond for clarification to some of the comments that were made.
Sure, Mr. Matthews, and if you can keep it relatively short, we have others, other bills to hear this evening.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. To Senator Rust's comment, all these provisions.
I take it back.
Thank you. And then also, can I just say that AMC does not at all look at this issue as a slight to the row officers. We think they're fantastic folks and do a great job. This is an issue that several counties have come to the legislature for because they are adopting similar language for their county specifically in the Beltrami bill, which is up next as a prime example. We agree with her that it should be a local issue and dealt with locally, and there are protections in place to make sure that folks do understand what's going on and that we do make sure that folks are involved in the process. And as I've pointed out earlier, it has worked where folks have, through the public process, have stopped the county board from going through with this. So, I think this is good legislation. I think that we've addressed those concerns.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Senator Olson, for bringing this bill back. Actually, the legislature passed this once already when Arne Carlson was governor. Arne, who had been a former state auditor, vetoed it. And in fact, I think I remember who the author of the legislation was. And
must have been you.
It was me. That's right. And I was on the state government committee back then, and county after county came in with requests to not have to go to the voters, and the legislature always granted it. And I do agree it should be a local decision, and I think with your reverse referendum, if there's any local controversy over it, that makes sense. But I think it's enough to have the county board run the county and make these positions appointed. I don't think they're major policy-making positions. I think that's more appropriate to be elected. They tend to be more, getting the work of the county done, and those that can be appointed. So I would like to move the bill when the time is appropriate.
Thank you, Senator Pappas. Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to support Senator Olson's bill, but I have to tell you that Ms. Solberg's defense of the current system is one of the most eloquent and compelling that I've ever heard. I mean, you make even though I'm going to support the bill, you make it hard, and that's the way we should be going about things here. That things are not just a slam dunk, but that there are arguments certainly for making these offices continue to be elected, and if they are not going to be elected, that it should be by exception rather than what the rule is. So I appreciate your testimony. It's some of the best I've heard to maintain the current system.
Senator Olson, I would, and Ms. Solberg, I would echo Senator Rest's comments, and I'm going to support the bill as well here tonight in the subcommittee. But I would mention to you that in the history of the time that I've been in the legislature, I've typically not voted for these bills. But I do think having a larger discussion in our state and local government, the full committee, on this issue is warranted, and I think that we should move forward with that. But I just wanted to add that to the record. Is there any further discussion? Seeing no further discussion, Senator Pappas moves that Senate File 124, as amended, be recommended to pass. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Motion passes. Thank you, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Olson, again, Senate File 1098.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 1098 is a...
Excuse me,
ready?
Senator Olson. Senator Gerlach.
Just interrupt for just a moment.
Yes.
There are multiple committees going on right now, and Senator Pappas is heading to one. I need to go in to check in to the K-12 Budget Division as well. So just so you know, we'll be back and forth. If there's a roll call vote, maybe you could track me down. I'll just be in room, 107, I believe.
What room will you be in, Senator Gerlach?
107.
107. Very good. Appreciate that, and...
Thank you.
Appreciate everyone's patience with the number of committees that we have going on. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 1098 is actually a bill that was authored by Senator Skoy, who is unable to be here this evening. And because it involves Beltrami County and we share that county, he's asked me to present this on his behalf. The proposed special legislation for Beltrami County would authorize the Beltrami County Board to make the Office of County Recorder appointive, which would be done through a resolution adopted by the Beltrami County Board after a public hearing. The County Board could reassign duties of the County Recorder to other department heads as long as the statutorily required functions of the office are carried out. And I guess the rest of the explanation is in the summary of the bill. This bill is similar to numerous other bills that have been adopted for various counties in the past few years to give them the same authority. And I think I would say specifically from my own personal knowledge that what prompted this bill is the fact that a lot of new technology in the county recorder's office has been put in place, some computer systems and other very technical systems. And I think it's important to the county board that they maintain the continuity of someone who's had the training with this very with these very technical systems. And I think that was the impetus for this request.
Thank you, Senator Olson. And that also, you may have mentioned it, but I But I can't recall if you mentioned that you're presenting this on behalf of Senator Skoy.
Yes, I did mention that, yeah. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Are there questions for Senator Olson? We are temporarily, because of the action in other committees, down to I don't feel comfortable voting on the bill with just two members. And so I know Senator Rest will be. Senator Gimsey and I, we probably could get a lot of work done here, huh?
Yeah, we'll kick it out.
Okay. Senator Rest will be back momentarily.
Okay.
And so we'll have a slight delay there. But yeah, I think, Senator Olson, what we can do is temporarily lay your bill over and move on to the testimony on the next bill, if that works for you. When we have another member, we can take action on your bill.
That's certainly fine with me, Mr. Chair. Do you need me to wait for that point, or once you have, do you, in case they have any questions, or what would you like me to do?
Senator Olson, are you, you'll be here in the Capitol, is that right?
Well, actually, I can stay for about another 15 minutes. Will that be, and my office is just right out the door.
Sure. Yeah, no, that would be just fine. I think we could get you. It's very likely that we won't need you to come back, but.
Okay.
Very good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And I see Mr. Olson here will keep track of things. Senator Wieger. Senator Wieger brings us Senate File 380.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 380 is an initiative from the Minnesota School Boards Association. Three main provisions. First, eliminates the requirement that a county, municipality, or school district get the approval of the county auditor before conducting an election by mail. Secondly, it permits the school board to decide whether or not to hold a primary election. And third, it confirms the school board's authority to use electronic voting systems in elections that are not held in conjunction with a statewide election. Mr. Chair, this bill passed unanimously or near unanimously last year in the Senate Elections Committee. A deadline issue in the other body prevented final passage. I have Tom Deans, counsel for MSBA, for questions.
Thank you, Senator Wieger. Mr. Deans.
Mr. Chair, the first section basically makes technical changes. It clarifies that what the notice period is to give notice to the county auditor. That's in compliance with existing law. It says that notice has to be in compliance with the rules that govern mail ballot elections. And it clarifies that the present law says the mail ballot procedures must be given at least 6 weeks before. And no one quite understands what that term means, and so it's clarified by saying they must be posted. The second and third section take the law back to where it used to be and makes it the same as it is for cities. The city or the school district can decide whether or not it wants to have a primary system or not. It will make that decision. If they choose to have a primary system, then if enough vote or enough candidates file, there'll be a primary. If they don't, then they would not be subject to a primary. That would move their filing dates back. Senator Larson, if I can add something here that kind of goes back to your bill earlier in the day. The way this law would work, if your bill were to become law, is in the even years, school board members would have to be filing, since primaries are mandatory, school board members would have to be filing either the last week in March or the first week in April. And then you may or may not have a primary, but then you're looking at about a seven-month election process, and they're really not very interested in having that. Under the old law, Before the mandatory primary bill went in, we had filings at the end of August and the beginning of September. They had about a two-month time period, and then you had the election. In 2005, there were about 20 primaries. In 2006, there were about 17. In most of those primaries, not all, but in most of them, there was only one person that was eliminated. We had a couple where you had a lot of people that filed, and there were more. But in most of them, because many times you have somebody running to fill a vacancy or they're running from an election district and you're paring down from three to two, and people can really make a decision where there's only three people or so running for a seat. The remainder of those would correct the filing periods if you did move to this system. Then Section 4 of the bill makes it clear that school districts can provide for the use of an electronic voting system. Now, this is all elections that are held by school districts after December 31 of this year have to be done electronically. So this makes it clear that we can do it. And if you're running, I end up with lots of school districts that are running an election at a different time. They want to do it electronically, but they've never complied with any of the other provisions for doing so. This just makes it clear that they can do it, and there's not some procedural hoop that they've had to go through, because the legislature says after this year they have to be done electronically, or they have to use the electronic system. And then it makes it clear that this will apply to elections beginning this year. This is the same system for the primary system. This is the same system that you use for city. They get to make their choice.
Thank you, Mr. Deans. Senator Wieger, do you have additional comments?
That concludes our testimony. I'm not aware of any opposition.
Senator Gimsey, do you have any questions for the witness?
In an effort to drag this out for a little bit here, no, I don't.
Very good. Thank you, Senator Gimsey, for your contribution there. Senator Wieger, I think that given the circumstances of the hearings going on in the Capitol tonight, I think we would like to keep the committee going. And so if Senator Gimsey would be so willing to move Senate File 380 to be recommended to pass. Senator Gimsey moves that Senate File 380 be recommended to pass. We will move it on to the full committee. Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify on this bill? Seeing no one coming.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Wieger.
Senator Skoglund may have some legislative history on this.
Senator Wieger, okay. We're going to hear from Senator Skoglund shortly. He's been very, very patient today. Senator Gimsey renews his motion that Senate File 380 be recommended to pass. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Wieger.
Thank you.
Senator Gimsey and Senator Betzel will be up next, but I will also entertain a motion for Senate File 1098.
So moved.
Thank you, Senator Gimsey. Senator Gimsey moves that Senate File 1098 be recommended to pass. And any further discussion? Is there anybody in the audience that had any concerns or wanted to testify further on Senate File 1098, which is Senator Skoy's bill presented by Senator Olson? Seeing no one coming forward, Senator Gimsey renews his motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. The bill is passed. Thank you, Senator Olson. Senator Betzel.
And Senator Olson, you never leave until the vote's taken, and then you leave as fast as you can. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, this does remind me many, many, many years ago, actually before I got to the Senate, the Data Practice Subcommittee was meeting late one night. It was just down to two members, Senator Gene Merriam and Senator Randy Peterson, who's now on the Court of Appeals. Those were the only two members left, and they were having this heated argument back and forth, and they passed the gavel back and forth as one made the pitch, then they passed the gavel, and the other made the pitch, and Senator Merriam was really trying to make the point, and to Senator Peterson, and Senator Peterson said, Senator, I hear you, but you just don't have the votes. So I think you can appreciate the situation. I have a bill. It's a rather simple bill, and it deals with a situation of what happens when you close down your campaign account, which none of us in the legislature have faced so far, but I have a former member of the legislature who is facing that situation. Now, I should caution the committee, subcommittee, he's kind of shy and kind of intimidated by this process, even though there's relatively few people here. But I will let my witness speak for himself, and if he would introduce himself.
Well, sir. Senator Betzold, at least half of the members of the committee that are present have served with your witness, and
you know,
you're not going to get that one by me, Senator Betzold. But I think the moral of your earlier story was that Senator Gimsey and I need to get along for the next several minutes there.
I think I think die in a tie vote. So, right.
Senator Skoglund, it's a pleasure to see you, and thank you for your patience. As you can see, we've done a lot of work tonight in the election subcommittee, and but it's a delight to see you, and thanks for being here.
Thank you, Senator Larson and Senator Gimsey. I'm Wes Skoglund. I'm a former member of the House and Senate. I served 30 years in the legislature, so I've put in more than a few of these late nighters. I have a unique problem, and it's a wonderful problem. I have excess funds in my campaign committee. I chose not to run for re-election. And we want to give away those funds to charitable organizations. The law limits giving from a campaign fund to a charitable organization. It has a cap of $50 on it. I think that's a good law for standing campaign committees, because I think you could be drained dry by people coming to you and asking you to give money to their organization. But I'm not running for anything. I'm done. I don't want to do this anymore. I had a wonderful time here, but I'm done. I don't want to do it. I want to give the money to three groups: South High Foundation, Roosevelt High Foundation, and the Friends of the Library, which is the Minneapolis Public Library System, their charitable arm. But I only can give them $50. And I would like to give them all that I have. I want to get rid of it. My treasurer has faithfully turned in her reports for 20-some years. She has been my treasurer, never been late, never doing anything. She says, I want out of this business. Let's write three checks and end it. And my campaign committee wants to do it this way. We had the people that raised the money over a few nights, or a couple Saturday nights ago. They thought it was great. We want to do it. This takes the cap off for people who are closing down their accounts and says we can give it away to charitable organizations without a limit, without a $50 limit.
Well, thank you, Senator Skoglund. Senator Betzold, you know, this probably, and we're not intending to open up the larger issue of contributions to charities, but I know that a number of local government officials, as a matter of fact, also struggle with this $50 statute as it relates to what becomes a campaign expenditure or a non-campaign expenditure as it relates to interacting with those organizations as well. And I know that's not where you're bringing to us tonight, but I think there's a whole additional area here that we'll have to address at some point in the future. But I know that your bill is very specific to this, and we've visited about this in the past as well. Is there any discussion on the bill or questions for Senator Betzold or former Senator Skoglund? Senator Gimsey.
Drag this out just a little bit. As far as charitable organizations, do you have any definement of that? Are you talking about 501c3s?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gimsey, that's correct.
Okay.
Senator Skoglund. Okay.
Senator
Skoglund.
Mr. Chairman, the law probably, and I use it probably, doesn't even allow you to give it to the government. You have to give it to a charitable arm, as I've read the statute and had the statute interpreted to me.
Well, if Mr. Watson can add anything to that, I don't know.
Mr. Watson, can you add to that?
Mr. Chairman, I wasn't aware of the limit on not giving it to the government.
Okay.
We should change that. Excuse me.
Was that? No, that was not a motion from Senator Gimsey. Now we have a deadlock. No. Senator Betzold, Senator Skoglund, I think we are ready. If there's, is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify on this bill? Seeing no one coming forward, Senator Gimsey.
I'd make the motion that we move Senate File 248 to the full committee.
Senator Gimsey moves that Senate File 248 be recommended to pass. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Bill is passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Gimsey.
Thank you, former Senator Skoglund and Senator Betzold. I would also entertain a motion from Senator Gimsey
as it relates to the minutes of our previous meeting.
I would move that acceptance of the minutes of the last meeting.
Senator Gimsey moves that we approve the minutes from our previous meeting, which is dated February 14th, 2007. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The minutes are adopted. Seeing no further business before the committee, before we adjourn, I'd just announce for those who are here, we will be meeting at 12:30 Friday, I believe in this room, here in this room, to take up additional elections bills. Stay tuned. We'll get that agenda out sometime tomorrow. And so if folks have questions, you can call Jason or Brenda. Seeing no further business before the committee is adjourned.